Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 10th, 2002. Today's session is titled, How to Respond to Religious Nationalism and Conflict Resulting from the 9/11 Tragedy. Session 3, The Role of Religious Leaders. This is presented by Joseph Bach. The number is BOJ2002-03. Let's listen in.
Third class of how to respond to the 9/11 tragedy, and especially dealing with religious nationalism and conflict that can result from that. I'm Joe Bach, and I guess we should let the tape start. So let's get started. I see some familiar faces and some new faces. So what I'm going to do today is go ahead and have a little bit of a recap summary for those of you who have been attending these classes or have attended one of them prior to this, and then we'll move into our material for today. Before I begin, I will tell you a bit about my background, and my wife isn't here yet, but she may be attending as well today, and I also want to give her credit for all the work that she's done in gallivanting around the world with our family. We worked in Pakistan, based in Islamabad, for 3 years, and I had a grant from the Kellogg Foundation, a fellowship that paid for research in India, and I focused on inter-religious violence, particularly in the slums of Ahmedabad in the state of Gujarat, where they recently encountered some really serious violence. And then we lived in Jerusalem for 3 years, and I was working again with Catholic Relief Services there, and was also teaching at Hebrew University. And now I'm at American Refugee Committee. We have programs in Africa and starting in Central Asia, one in Thailand for refugees from Burma, and then also have programs in the Balkans where we deal with inter-religious ethnic conflict on a regular basis with host country nationals and returning refugees. We've had staff members who have to go to work with flak jackets on, where they have mined houses, booby-trapped houses where people are returning. And so we experience this sort of inter-ethnic violence on a regular basis. We are really focused internationally. My research has been focused internationally. And so I'm asking all of you to help make sure that we keep this focused on the American context, more so than international. So that's your job today. Now, a brief review about what we've done. We've defined some terms, and we started out on the first day making a distinction between three main terms that I want to provide real quick definitions to you for. Bigotry. It is thinking our group is better than another group and being mean about it. That's bigotry. Whereas religious nationalism is thinking that our religion is better than other religions to the point of exclusivity. Oftentimes this results in bigotry. Neither necessarily result in violence. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Depends on a lot of the circumstances. Patriotism, in contrast, is being proud of your country. It's flying the flag. It's walking in a parade. It doesn't necessarily relate at all to nationalism. Those terms often get confused or misused. But there are quite a few people who get concerned about politicians combining patriotism with religion, because oftentimes that can fuel religious nationalism inside a community, and that can result in bigotry and violence. We also have talked about how it's important not to exclusively focus on physical aggression, that is to say, violence, but to understand that we need to understand aggression in a much broader sense. And I had I was a part of a project in Jerusalem where we had students from three different universities, Hebrew, Hebron, and Bethlehem universities, involved in doing research on incitement, using religion to incite people into violence. And they found that there were five kinds of aggression. The first was physical aggression, violence. There was electronic aggression over the internet, an unbelievable amount. There was symbolic aggression, using religious symbols in a provocative way as a way of inciting violence. There was written aggression, you know, flyers or those sorts of things that were passed out after times of worship. And there was verbal aggression, often emanated out of the pulpit, through the minaret, or whatever, in also helping people to develop what some scholars have called sacred rage, holy hatred, sanctified bloodshed.
Where is Sharon's going to the Al-Qaeda?
Yeah, that would fall really into, I would say, the religious, symbolic aggression, right? And I want to clarify also, and this is something that a lot of people have helped me learn over time, that you don't want to only focus on trying to prevent violence, that it's really almost more important that you try to prevent aggression at early stages before it gets to the point of violence. Because it's then that you can usually prevent polarization from occurring. Now, something that we haven't covered in previous classes is that there is this understanding, and I want to cover first of all this. There is this understanding on the part of a lot of practitioners in what's called conflict transformation, because the argument is you really never can really resolve conflict. You've got to have mechanisms to help in a healthy way transform it within your society. There is a viewpoint that is articulated predominantly by John Paul Lederach, who is now at Notre Dame. He used to be at Eastern Mennonite University, and one of his books is in the bookstore here. I highly recommend his writings. I think they're great. But John Paul Lederach argues that it's best to focus on the middle level of leadership when you're trying to deal with these sorts of problems, because they have influence at the grassroots level, but they also have influence with top-level leaders, say, you know, the politicians, the heads of the country, diplomats bringing international pressure to bear, and that sort of thing. What I feel is a bit of a mistake is if we focus only on this level and forget about the fact that oftentimes aggression is happening at this level, and if you're going to arrest it early, it has to be at that level. It tends to get fairly blown out of proportion and becomes more of a macro social thing once it gets up to this level. So the challenge is how to efficiently and effectively deal with aggression at a grassroots level. That's the challenge that we face. Now, what our discussion for today is related to certain tactics, certain approaches that people can use in their communities, say at a grassroots level, to try to arrest aggression at an early stage, particularly among religious leaders. And I think that what we need to do is to go through the five approaches today, and then these have been described on, I think, the flyer that was up on the board at the kiosk, the five different approaches. We'll go through those today, and then I would like to ask you if you have any examples of those types of approaches being used in your community, if you've used them or if you've seen other people using them. Before we get to that, I want to share something with you that relates to why we need to counteract aggression that has religious overtones with a religious response or a spiritual response. In this, I borrow from psychiatry. Any of you here a psychiatrist or a psych? Okay, can you explain to us, I'm sure you can do it much better than I can, the theory of the double bind as it relates to schizophrenia?
Yeah, I think I could come up with something. Double bind is a no-win situation. It's where if you say yes, you lose. The traditional sort of double bind that was thought to, back in the 40s to be schizophrenogenic, create schizophrenia, was the mother that created a situation for her child in which if the child tried to assert himself to become an individual separate from the mother, that she would withdraw love or criticize or undercut. And if he tried to comply with her or fuse with her, that he would lose himself and become totally dominated and feel kind of anxiety and tension about loss of his own individuality. And so either way, you either comply or you assert yourself, you lose.
So you're in a double bind, hence the name.
Yeah.
In terms of religion, and I'm borrowing here from some Indian scholars who have been critical of approaches used in India to try to deal with what, in India, there's a problem that they often refer to it as communalism, communal violence. Often Hindu, Muslim, increasingly Muslim, Christian, and sometimes within the Muslim tradition, Shia, Sunni. That's a particular problem in certain parts of Pakistan. There's incredible violence between Sunnis and Shias. So. Anyway, within the context of communalism, religious violence, people often, social service organizations often respond by bringing about more of a secular, we need to have a secular society. Those sorts of explanations, or religion is bad, as if all religion is bad. And as we've talked about through this course, remember we've talked about how religion is a little bit, religion is not a double-edged sword. It seems to be a sword on the side of bringing about division, but it seems to be a butter knife on the side of love. And it seems in some respects that you've got to cultivate the side on the butter knife deliberately in order for religion to work that way. So they're trying to deal with it, and many times people think the only thing we can do is secularize ourselves. So in doing that, and this goes back to the double bind, it's like we want you to abandon who you are, including your core identity of religion, in order to be able to embrace a public good of tolerance and pluralism. And as a result, you get what I would call almost a social schizophrenia, which results in a fundamentalist backlash. Yes, I mean, you can look at it. It happens in different communities in India. It's the same sort of thing. So, in other words, if you've got a place where you've got a lack of appreciation for pluralism, it seems to me you can go one of two ways. You can secularize and move to reluctant secularism. Your hold on to religious beliefs is asking for abandonment of those, your core identity. Your vision is inclusive. But your propensity for violence may be low, but with a potential for a double bind backlash. In contrast to this, you can ask for what I am calling a vibrant religion, where you ask people to embrace the faith, the major thrust of their faith tradition. It's like this Jesuit priest friend of mine that I work with in India, and got to know well. He goes into the slums and he says, you know what? I want you to be a good Muslim. I want you to be a good Hindu. I want you to be a good Christian. And the overwhelming tendency in your faith is of peace. It's of respecting those people of the book. Now, in the case of Hinduism, it wouldn't be those people of the book. But when you're talking about Muslims and Jews and Christians, those people of the book. And you use imagery like that. So it's more of the vibrant religion rather than the reluctant secularism. The hold on to religious beliefs, tight. Embrace who you are. We don't want to put you into a double bind. Tight. Vision, grounded in religion, but celebrating differences. Not tolerating them, you know, like the word tolerance. We're celebrating those differences. And then the propensity for violence, low, provided that fundamentalist exclusivity is not allowed to take hold. And I would argue that that almost requires diligence. I mean, it seems like it may be a part of the human condition. A friend of mine who is a rabbi in Jerusalem, I know that Susan knows him, Yehesko Landau, I don't know if he's technically a rabbi, Yehesko, but I mean, he's definitely a religious leader. You know, he makes the point that, you know, whether you like religion or not, people are going to be religious. So you just as well learn how to deal with it. And to the extent that people are going to be religious and you're going to have to deal with it, it seems to me that you're going to have to help them in a way that is very deliberate, very well thought out, very systematic to deal with religious differences. Right now in the United States, we've got people who want to, you know, put graffiti all over the mosques. They want to rip out the loudspeakers. They want to say, you know, America's a Christian nation. You don't belong here. Take your scarves off in school. All that sort of thing. People need to understand that they can be, you know, whatever faith they are, and they need to be comfortable in that. And at the same time, they need to be comfortable with the diversity of others. Now, we need to go. Are there any questions about that?
Other than the fact that many people's comfort, let alone his comfort, when it's an exclusivist notion, that anything else makes them awfully damn uncomfortable.
Well, I think that's right, and that's the big challenge here. It's I guess I would argue that.
So in a way, they're in a double bind.
In a way, the way that they've been brought up is I haven't really thought of that as a double bind. Maybe it is, but I think the big challenge is from as people are being raised. If you think of the enterprises of religion. I mean, all of the buildings that we have, all of the ministers that we have, all of the seminaries that we have. That's why I think it's a little bit like there's a little lever on the side of the rudder on a ship that you turn on the other side that helps the rudder go over. We've got to figure out what that little one is. And if we can do that, we can turn the whole ship. And it's going to take a while. And eventually, you know, the oil tanker is going to, you know, start going into a major direction down the road. We have to change the way that seminaries do their education, the way that religious leaders are trained in. It can't just be, how do you help people get closer to God? How do you help people who have been through a crisis, etc.? All that's real important. You know, what are the major theological parts of our faith? All that's real important. But we need to have, in classes, at seminaries, we need to have, you know, Sunday morning or Saturday morning classes on how do you deal with religious differences. And what do you do when somebody says a bigoted joke at your dinner table? I mean, we've got to start really getting, really focusing on that and turn that little lever over there and get the oil tanker off onto the other.
Have you seen any like interfaith relations between schools, like Muslim schools, Christian schools, to sort of breed an awareness for other faiths, or?
Well, I would say, that's a good question. This project that I was involved in Jerusalem, we called it the Track to Anti-Incitement Project, which is a mouthful. But there's a whole domain of diplomacy called Track to Diplomacy, where you get like academicians and other people like that involved in, you know, figuring out something like the Oslo Accords, and then you get the official people involved, and they kind of work the deal out, and they, you know, figured out that it would work, that sort of thing. It's Track to Diplomacy. There, during the Y River Plantation Agreement, there was a formation of something called an Anti-Incitement Committee. Israelis, Palestinians, and prominent Americans, such as Theodore Heisberg from Notre Dame, he was appointed to that. So we created something called the Track 2 Anti-Incitement Project, where we would try to get religious leaders involved, or at least get an understanding of what religious leaders were doing. Hence, we got these students from Hebron, Hebrew, and Bethlehem universities. There was a time when the Israeli students invited the Bethlehem University and Hebron University students to their campus. And we had a session at the Truman Institute, and they planned a, passing out brochures on their campus to stand up to religious nationalism. Mm-hmm. So that I have seen it work in that respect. And it was a very difficult thing even to get passes for the people from, say, Hebron to be able to come to Jerusalem to the Mount Scopus campus at Hebrew University. Yes?
You know, if you look at us as a country, we've evolved a lot over the years to where we accept more. I mean, we've gone from burning witches in Salem and from rejecting the Malcolm X, and you can cite all types of things, you know, that we've gone through, even through Ku Klux Klan and rejecting that to modifying it, et cetera, you know, over time. But I think there's a real danger in getting so wishy-washy in our beliefs that we forget what we talked about in Romans this morning, you know. We can also lose sight of our own faith if we
right.
go too far. But I'm wondering in my mind, when you're talking about, like, the Muslim reaction today, you're separating that as a little difference in discourse of what we're saying in terms of handling. You're talking more like the violence and the hate that just comes from the emotional situation, or
well,
from...
No, what I'm saying, I mean, I appreciate your question because it's what people do feel like. I don't want to abandon my core beliefs on the altar of pluralism or secularization. And that's fundamentally the problem that I think is often made. We don't want to do that. In fact, we want people to be fully grounded in their faith, to not take their certain, you know, passages from holy books out of context, to look at the major thrust of their faith, but to fully embrace that. That's what I mean by vibrant religion. And so, you know, the question is, and this is kind of skipping to tomorrow, but I'll bring it up right now. The question is, so how do you deal, I mean, how do you view other faith traditions? Even if you feel that, you know, and I do, as a Christian, I feel like mine is the true religion. I mean, it is the best vessel to heaven I've found so far. I'll put it that way. If you're looking for your vessel to heaven, like we all are, I'll put my, you know, I'll put all my chips in the Christian vessel, okay? But I can value, you know, the Muslim vessel, the Jewish vessel, the Hindu vessel, the Buddhist vessel. And how do I do that? Christer Stendhal gave a lecture at the Church of the Redeemer in Jerusalem. And he articulated something, former dean of Harvard Divinity School, he articulated something that I think is very, very helpful. He calls it holy envy. Holy envy. To be envious of the beautiful traits of other religions in a holy way. I envy that Jewish people, at least Orthodox Jewish people, keep the Sabbath holy. I wish I did that more. I mean, I try not to read the business section of the newspaper on Sunday. That's about how far it goes. I envy the fact that Muslims pray five times a day. Yep. I mean, they're driving along, you know, they're a semi driver, they stop on the side of the road, they pull their prayer rug out, they pray. It's not convenient. I envy the fact that Buddhists really know how to meditate well. I've tried to import that into my saying of the rosary. I'm a Catholic, I say the rosary. And I try to import Buddhist meditation, repetitive prayer, chant into my rosary. And I'm going to borrow, I'm going to try to keep my Sundays more holy, and I'm going to try to pray more often. You understand what I'm saying? So it's holy envy, and I don't necessarily have to feel like, you know, I don't feel any less because you're my friend or you're in my community. I find it wonderful. You've got a different perspective than mine. I mean, some of the Hindu ways of looking at things are so different. It's unbelievably educational, you know? And they would say that there are, you know, many of them would say they're not polytheistic. They understand God in different forms.
Buddhism, too.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that there are certain things about those religions that we can identify that we find are enviable. Yes?
Either today or as you go forward, can you address the evangelical thrust of Christianity? Because that's a key cutting point, it seems to me, that I run into in celebrating diversity, which is my inclination, and to really celebrate the vibrancy of another faith, but at the same time having this sort of great commission inside kind of sticking in my gut, am I just ignoring this go and make disciples of, etc.?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question. I'm going to go ahead and... This was class number four, but we're going to do it, okay? And so we've done holy envy. The second thing for tomorrow is this. We'll get to the five tactics tomorrow. Okay. No. There's I'll share with you, it's a Catholic perspective. And I can get you the actual citation of it in the Catholic Catechism if you want, but it's something called the Baptism of Desire. And essentially what the Baptism of Desire is that if someone it boils down to this. Baptism is a function of the state of soul rather than the having participated in a sacred ritual. And so, you know, I can go and understand that my Muslim friend is very close to God. He would understand it, he or she would understand it as being close to Allah. And I can try as much as I can to live out my faith and ask that person to live out his or her faith and get closer to God, and in so doing, be baptized in their soul. And therefore, my sense of needing to feel like I have to, in a sense, convert him or her is really not a question. Now, if they come to me and they ask me, well, you know, why did you move your family all the way over here to Islamabad? Is it because you kind of like reading National Geographic and you thought this would be an interesting place to visit? Or was there some other reason? You can share with them, no, I think this is a part of my Christian faith. And they say, well, I don't understand Christianity. I thought all Christians were people who, watch Baywatch or whatever those shows are at night and, you know, go to the beach in bikinis and, you know, shop at Walmart, drink a lot of alcohol, you know, that sort of thing. And you can help them understand that. That's an opportunity. It's kind of a teaching moment. But for me, theologically, this whole evangelical thrust is, in a sense, I want to be evangelical by the way that I live. I don't necessarily feel any compulsion to help others get to the point of wanting to be baptized because I think that they can do that in their soul through this doctrine called baptism of desire. Now, I've taken this a step further in my own mind, in that I believe that, you know, the transformation of religion, where you've got, remember the double-edged sword, you've got the negative side of religion bringing about more hatred and et cetera, division being the sword, and you've got the butter knife on the other side. I think that the transformation of the butter knife into a powerful instrument requires the power of the Holy Spirit. Now, Muslims aren't going to call it the power of the Holy Spirit. Jews aren't going to call it the power of the Holy Spirit. Hindus, etc., are not going to call it the power of the Holy Spirit. Well, in my mind, it's similar, not similar, but comparable to or parallel to the baptism of desire. I call it instrument of desire. They are instruments, in my mind, of the Holy Spirit. It's a state of their soul. It's just like some of the writings on the Holy Spirit being depicted, and I know this is a Christian way of looking at it, but it's depicted often with words of light, you know? And so if you're open to let that light shine on you, it doesn't matter whether you have a certain conceptual apparatus in your head or not, that light is shining on you, and you're able to transform this negative side into the positive side, the butter knife side.
We were talking in Romans this morning about law as a as basically a word for construct, the framework. And what you're saying, tell me if I'm getting this right, is that the framework is just a framework.
Right.
It's the substance that's important.
That's right.
And language is another framework. And what Paul was saying is, don't be a slave to the law. Don't be a slave to the framework.
Right.
What's important is,
in a sense, the state of soul and right. receptivity to love.
Right. That's
right.
Is that?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So now that we've conducted class 4, maybe we should go back to class 3. But those are great, great, very good questions. Okay, we want to go through the five different approaches that one can use in responding to religious nationalism. And this is from an article that a friend of mine, Clark McCulley, he's at the University of Pennsylvania. They have something there called the Solomon Asch Center for Study of Ethno-Political Conflict. And he is a social psychologist, and he and I have been trying to really get at the crux of the social psychology of these areas and try to distill out what the social psychological processes are as distinct from the spiritual ones. There is a residual that's unexplained, it seems, by social psychology. And that is a spiritual, there is definitely is a spiritual dimension that one has to address. Now let's start with gatekeeping. Let me give you the definition of gatekeeping, and then as we go, maybe people will have examples. Gatekeeping is helping a potential religious nationalist to keep the overwhelming thrust of a faith tradition as the major emphasis rather than specific passages of a sacred text. So, in other words, you're keeping the gate on the theological integrity of your faith tradition with a co-religionist. Important point, a co-religionist.
What do you mean by that?
In other words, someone of your own faith. And this is something...
You're speaking to somebody in your own tradition
right.
that says, wait a minute, you know, I need to look at the whole thrust here instead of...
Right.
A little bit of it.
Exactly. Rather than this specific passage, I want you to try to really emphasize the major thrust of our faith tradition. And the reason that the whole point about a co-religionist emphasis is important is that if you go, in other words, if you were to go to a Muslim and say, you know, the Quran doesn't really say that. I mean, the Quran may say that in this one passage, but it really doesn't say that in the main. Well, you get into this shouting match kind of thing. You end up escalating tension rather than reducing tension. and the Carnegie Commission on Preventing Deadly Conflict. They've got a website. It's great. If you go under a good search engine, Carnegie Commission on Preventing Deadly Conflict, they send out a free executive summary of their report. One of the main points that they made was that religious leaders need to be prepared to confront their co-religionists when they start becoming bigoted. And so I'm going to go ahead and put this this graphic up. And we'll talk a little bit about this as we go. But basically, within this graphic, what I'm talking about is co-religionists, and we'll get into theological duels, but you're dealing a violence-preventing leader confronting a violence-promoting leader, okay? So the confrontation or the dialogue needs to take place there. Okay, gatekeeping and nudging. Or I'm sorry, does anybody have an example of doing gatekeeping? Yes.
We have in our town an organization called Hate Free Santa Rosa, and then also Hate Free Sonoma County, which is made up of religious leaders and community leaders throughout that has, we have basically a covenant around bigotry, and we work with different organizations to adopt being a hate-free organization, and they get stickers and magnets and things, and particularly for store owners, things that say we are a hate-free business, et cetera, that kind of thing, to really get the idea of creating a hate-free community. And there's an organization of religious leaders that has the primary Protestant and Catholic and Jewish and Muslim members in it, but there is a group of fundamentalist Christian leaders who have not been willing to join up the hate-free thing because of the stand around gay and lesbian issues. But there are people with, there are religious leaders within, Christian leaders within this group who maintain relationship and dialogue with members of the fundamentalist group in the way that, you know, you're describing.
So Christian to Christian.
Christian to Christian, yeah.
Theological gatekeeper.
Right, theological gatekeeper, yeah. Uh-huh. So they're not part of our group, but they, we're in dialogue with them.
Okay, that's great.
And they're willing to, you know, there's certain things that they agree to, and they passed, you know, resolutions on the things that we agree on, even though they haven't joined because they disagree fundamentally about certain things.
Okay, that's a great example. Thank you. Any other examples? Well, let's move on. Gatekeeping and nudging. Some of the research that was done in the Balkans, very interesting, will again use a social psychological concept of cognitive dissonance. There was cognitive dissonance identified in some of the fundamentalist leaders, fundamentalist religious leaders, whereby the rhetoric that was, in a sense, poisonous in terms of interreligious tension was inconsistent with the major thrust of their theological training. And this was detected on the part of some of the researchers in the Balkans that, you know, there were these alliances between, in a sense, say, Orthodox monks or Orthodox priests, and people like Milosevic. They had clear linkages. Sometimes it's not so clear, but there were linkages there. So the question is there cognitive dissonance that this person has, and would it be better to confront this person who is starting to fuel, through their rhetoric, religious division? And is it best to confront that person privately rather than to confront that person publicly, particularly if they are feeling cognitive dissonance? And so gatekeeping and nudging is privately encouraging an incipient religious nationalist to discontinue emanating messages of division. So it might be something to the effect of, walking in and saying, look, noticed yesterday your speech that was reported in the paper, it looks like some of the things that you're saying are really taking some of our passages out of context. And I'm wondering if you realize how some of the politicians are going to be using that in order to solidify their votes within a particular religious constituency that has a particular religious identity. And so you sit down and you talk with that person and try to kind of nudge that person away. And it kind of goes back to the idea that, you really don't want to slap somebody's face in public unless you have to.
What's the difference between the nudging and the gatekeeping? I'm missing
The gatekeeping is really when somebody isn't really being a religious, kind of a religious bigot yet. They just seem to be misinformed. Whereas the other one is that they're really tempted by the power, the prestige. You see what I mean? I mean, they're really kind of going down that road already, and the question is, can you nudge them off of it? Any examples of that? The only examples I can think of are in the Balkans and some of that, where that was attempted at, or maybe it was even being suggested ex post facto. It would have been a good strategy if we would have thought of it then.
Well, I don't know if this is an example, but religious, but it's more political. But there's a person who is associated with Holden, who works at Fields Point. And he was wearing a cap with a Confederate flag on it. And so I felt very offended by that. I am offended by a Confederate flag.
Right.
Because of what it conveys around
right.
Slavery and racial issues. And so I tried to nudge him, not by saying, you're right, I'm right, you're wrong, but the question, I said to him, do you understand what message you're sending to people who are going to Holden Village with that cap being what greets you when you come to pay your parking fee? And he did understand and had a different interpretation of what the meaning of that symbol was. And so my job was not to say your interpretation was wrong. My job was to say, let me explain to you that this is how I experienced that. And
right.
This is what I'm walking away with.
Okay.
So it's,
Did he stop wearing the hat?
I asked my father-in-law, who came through a week later, and he was wearing a different hat.
Okay.
Now, whether or not raising the issue, or he just has a different hat for a different day, we don't know.
Right.
But,
And you raised this issue with him privately?
Privately.
Okay.
Yeah, this is the first time I didn't want to make it a public issue.
Right.
Using this as an educational thing, so.
Right. That's a great example, though. I mean, that's, you pull somebody aside. I mean, again, that's symbolic aggression. Right? I mean, it was symbolic aggression. And that's precisely what this thing conveys. I mean, there are different things that appear to be aggressive to different people. What some of the Muslims are saying is very aggressive, we feel, to us. But some of the moderate Muslims don't realize that we see it that way. So we've got to communicate back to those moderate Muslim leaders that, hey, we're seeing this as aggressive. You need to deal with those people. You see what I mean? I think that that's probably the way that we have to approach this problem.
Joe, can I ask a question?
Yes.
So in your triangular diagram, then, each of these the points of the triangle represents a different tradition, either religiously or something like that.
Right, a different faith tradition. That's right.
Okay, thanks.
You know, without involving faith, we have to approach a lot of this in the workplace nowadays, right, too, because you deal with employees much differently than we used to in terms of what they convey, even the jokes in the workplace, but it approaches that same approach.
Good.
One example that's kind of a mild one. In our church, there is a cadre of pro-life folks who most of them are very well-intentioned, good people, and attempting to live out their Christian walk. But during the times where abortion bombing was going on, there was a kind of a little bit of enthusiasm, a little bit of sort of us, them, you know, it's finally coming down to it, you know, and rally around this sort of force for life. And talking with a couple of them, kind of delicately, because it was a pretty, tense tripwire kind of an issue for them, asking them about, well, is it that you're pro-life or you're anti-abortion? And if you're pro-life, how about this bombing of abortion clinics and shooting of abortion doctors? And just kind of asking some questions about, you know, the loving context of this that they are espousing under the name of pro-life, sort of in their own context.
Right.
And it did seem over time that people sort of softened their rhetoric and kind of took a little more embracing kind of love and life promoting and kind of didn't quite so enthusiastically go towards that side, even though they weren't part of that.
Right.
They were in that sort of potential follower group.
That's a great example.
That's a great, yeah.
Yeah, that's really good.
I'd like to say, I think gender issues are another, especially in religious fundamentalism, views of gender and how women are regarded in a culture, whether they're, you know, appropriate for the priesthood or how they should dress and who has control over women, is an important, I think gender issues are key to fundamentalism. And so to not address gender jokes or to stuff that's really just inbred into our way of kind of laughing at gender differences and
right,
gender issues, I think is at the core of some religious fundamentalism. And it needs to be seen as that.
Uh-huh.
As part of
that's
violence against women that's perpetuating in our context and our jokes and in our ads and
right,
violence against women, which
yeah,
is the core to religious fundamentalism.
I think, you know, my wife, Sue, who's sitting behind you, had an email picture sent to her recently. Sue, do you want to tell everybody about that?
It was sent by a relative of two women that said, who's got freedom? And it was supposed to be the Americans, and it was of a Muslim woman in chador and kurta, completely covered, and then an American woman in a very scanty bikini. And I took great offense at both of those images, knowing Muslim women who are very supportive of at least some sort of curtis, some sort of covering, and also offensive, that portrayal of an American woman's freedom and what you're looking at when you see that. And so did write back to him my feelings, and he wrote back and said he was very sorry. And it was an interesting little brief exchange in email, but it's that kind of thing.
I just believe it's core.
Mm-hmm.
Gender patriarchy protects views of women, status of women, women and their sexuality is core to some of the violence.
Because it's really setting up a power differential that seems to be commonly accepted, and therefore if it's accepted so commonly, why not have it along religious lines or ethnic lines or whatever? That's really a good point. I never thought of that.
It's one of the pivotal points of fundamentalism, literal interpretation of text, subjugation of women, and until we address that, is this fundamental suspicion, hatred, and violence against women that is in every culture. I think that perpetuates violence and a dominance that is core to coming to some understanding of religious fundamentalism and the violence that it perpetuates.
Okay, I'm really grateful that we're getting all this tape, because this is really helpful. let's move on to the third approach. And this is one that I refer to as theological dueling. And maybe I watched The Three Musketeers too much when I was a little kid growing up, but the image that comes into my mind is that you are having a public duel, which is theological. And so it kind of goes back to, you know, what are we doing in the seminary in addition to helping seminary, future religious leaders become able to deal with pastoral issues and that sort of thing? Are we also helping them learn how to deal with religious nationalism? And can they do that publicly? So you move from this private, behind-the-scenes sort of thing to a public clashing of swords, as it were. Now, the best example I know of a theological duel is from a rabbi in Jerusalem who stood up to a Jewish militant group that was about to do symbolic aggression using the head of a pig in the Old City. And he stood up to them and apologized to the Muslim community for what they were about to do. The group was arrested by the Israelis. He ended his public apology to the Muslims with a greeting to them, "We hope that you have a good Ramadan," because Ramadan was just starting their time of fasting. So in a sense, he was publicly standing up saying, "This is not what our faith is all about. I don't agree with this." He had, and I think this is critical, he had the authority and legitimacy to be able to do that. And we had this graphic up yesterday, but to give you the basic point here is that you had a Jewish militant group trying to promote violence. They were doing it in a provocative way to incite bloodshed. And then you had a conflict preventing authority figure, this rabbi, who stood up to them in an effort to prevent other followers from going over here, but instead keeping them over here to the point to where the victims would not end up being treated with cruelty or violence. So that's the, those are the three categories that really deal mainly with the approach that you would use. Does anybody else have an example of those, of theological dueling? No? Sue?
I can't remember the specifics, but didn't Frank Graham come out with some inflammatory remarks after September 11th? Does anyone remember?
Who?
Frank Graham, he was the minister who led the prayer at President Bush's inauguration, son of Billy Graham. I think he said something very hurtful toward Muslims. I can't even remember the specifics, but there was quite a public outcry. I don't know what took place privately in terms of nudging or gatekeeping, but certainly there was a public outcry of other religious, well, Christian and Jewish leaders in response to that.
And Jerry Falwell made a very famous.
He did also. I would have that.
Okay. Yeah.
But I think the feeling that Frank Bush had the president's ear made it more potent at that time. Even though President Bush
had
come up
for a
different thing.
It's, yes?
Well, this is another subject. I was thinking about some of the stuff that Farrakhan has come out with, and what comes out of his mouth is not always sweet and light, and so there's been a lot of discussion among our church body, Episcopalian, and we talk at coffee hour about stuff like that. And he just, you know, kind of said,
it seems to me that one of the things that I have missed here is that there needs to be a whole nother two circles in each of these, and they need to be the civil society political domain, where you have certain civic leaders or politicians who are moderate who can confront the aggressive politicians also. And so it would be almost a multidimensional sort of arrangement. But I think, you know, we need to face facts that we do oftentimes need to link up the politicians as well as the religious leaders, because the alliances between the two, and I mentioned this yesterday, that this fundamentalism project, which was done at University of Chicago, did identify the fact that some fundamentalist religious leaders may or may not have formed an alliance with politicians who exploit their rhetoric for their own political ends. It seems that some of them are kind of just totally, you know, out there just espousing this stuff without concern of its political implications, whereas others know very well exactly how it's going to be used and are doing it deliberately for that purpose. But in any case, I think it would be useful to, say, have a moderate, you know, civic leader and a bigoted civic leader / politician, and have an ability to link up with them in order to address them. And that would go back more to the top tier on that pyramid structure that I had put up earlier. Yes?
I was just thinking about Alan Keyes and his new program. He takes on some of these really hard issues, but from a Christian point of view, he certainly has a great respect for other people's views, and he seems to come through with that. It seems to me to be clear that he's always in consideration. I mean, he's really opinionated, obviously, but he's at least engaging people in the conversations if they're able to have differences and so, learn more and educate yourself more about the differences.
I think what's really a challenge here, if we go back to the idea of, you know, making the butter knife turn into more of a sharper part of the sword, you know, building a structure like this, including, you know, identifying political leaders who could potentially confront the religious nationalist or those who are you know, leaning in that direction, to set up a structure like this is a lot of work. It's a little bit like, and I guess the what I would hope to see someday would be almost like something comparable to an Amnesty International that would be set up to set these things up in countries that are in locations where there's a lot of interfaith tension. Almost the wiring of it, in a sense, the creating of the network, and then you have the activities that are designed to have interfaith dialogue, and it's interfaith dialogue with a very specific purpose, and that is to say that we want you to know that if people in our faith tradition start saying things that offend you, we want you to call us, and vice versa, we'll do the same with you. That sort of thing, and then to go through some sort of training to where people would be prepared to stand up to it. And, you know, certain things like adding a gender dimension to it and that sort of thing, I think would be very productive. So, anyway, we talked about theological dueling. Let me give you the definition. When a religious leader authoritatively confronts a religious nationalist of his or her own faith tradition so as to prevent potential followers from being influenced in the direction of violence towards another religious group. Okay, the fourth one that we need, yes?
Yeah, this would be a really good forum for the Lutheran Church as a whole to take on, because I think, you know, when you talk about fight or flee, the Lutheran Church flees when it comes to national issues of very importance. You know, we have a great faith base, but they really, it's the exceptional Lutheran pastor that would ever deal with these type of issues, in my opinion.
Well, and I think that's why, you know, in this gets into class five, you're wonderful because you anticipate them way way ahead of time. I really appreciate it. No, it's great. Because what the real trouble here, and it's something I mentioned a little bit yesterday, if you can imagine, you know, the justice scale, the lawyer scale, the overwhelming amount of effort, if you look at what programs are being funded by foundations, what a lot of social service organizations are emphasizing, they're emphasizing interfaith dialogue, okay, to an incredible extent. The whole thing of trying to set up a system to confront interfaith aggression gets hardly any attention. Almost virtually none. And so what really is needed from the standpoint of investment in this to correct this problem is to at least get balance, if not put more over here. Now, why doesn't it? And so you've got to ask yourself, you know, why is it like this? Well, part of that is that, you know, building interfaith harmony in going to wine and cheese parties is more pleasant than confronting a colleague, a co-religionist, which is oftentimes, you know, very challenging, gut-wrenching. Sometimes you can be considered an alarmist. You may have a theological duel and lose and be discredited. You see what I mean? I mean, it's difficult. That's why I really think there's got to be some way to encourage it and get this. And I think there does need to be a refocus on the philanthropic investment so that people, you know, start getting grant money and things to set up training programs with religious leaders to help them really understand how important this is and how to do it. I mean, I don't think that the techniques are really developed substantially yet. I think there's a lot of techniques on how to, you know, mediate a dispute to prevent war between diplomats or maybe in a track two kind of thing. There's a lot of discussion about, you know, effective dialogue and that sort of thing. But this kind of stuff, I don't think there's very much at all.
I've got the right here, the ELCA social statement on peace. And I was just kind of flipping through it and seeing if there was anything like what you're talking about. And it's true. Uh-huh. Now, this was written in 95, is what it says. And it doesn't have it has a lot of stuff on interfaith dialogue and on promoting a culture of peace and stuff like that. But none of the stuff you're talking about is in here. I'll put it back in the Resource Center just in case.
Anyway, I'm calling this relaying and advocating, okay? So what you do is you relay the information and then you advocate within your faith tradition. And again, I think we should add the political dimension as well. And the final one is safeguarding, and I see that we're running out of time, but I just want to say we're actually out of time. Safeguarding is literally, best example I've heard was yesterday, Ben Stewart's mother is here from Moscow, Idaho, and the University of Idaho in Moscow contacted her community's peace committee to see if they were interested or they would be willing to provide safe haven to Muslim students on campus, get them off campus, and put them in their homes to safe keep them following 9/11 if things started getting bad. Now, they didn't. But that's an example of what, you know, religious leaders can do. I mean, there are instances when I know this this group in India that I did a case study of, they provided safe haven to Muslims who were being pursued by a violent Hindu mob in a I think it was a Catholic convent where they provided safe haven. So literally sometimes when there's physical, imminent physical aggression, safe haven is important.
And this Hate Free Santa Rosa group after 9/11 organized a watch program for the local mosque.
Okay.
Where people would do shifts.
That's,
you know, basically that, hanging out.
That's great. That's exactly, this group in Moscow did the same thing. And I guess the mosque had gotten some graffiti. But I want to go ahead and provide you with, maybe you, if, I don't know if you want to, I think it's great if people are interested, if they could learn more about your group. And Ben's mother said that you could contact her, and I'm just going to write down her email address if you're interested.
Yeah, I don't have, unfortunately, I don't have the website with me
okay.
here, but my card is out there on the peace table if people want to find out. The whole hate-free community movement is actually, does anybody have that in any of their other communities? Hate-free community, you haven't heard of it? Because there's a lot of communities in California that are actually doing this. It's really kind of fun. A lot of good food.
And your brochure is out. The brochure of your group contact is out.
Yeah, that's a different thing.
Different
though.
Thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's an international thing. This is a
right. this is a domestic thing.
But I can get information on it. I'll put my card out.
Okay. Great. Okay. Well, thank you very much today. I'd be happy to answer any questions afterwards out at the ARC if you have any. Thank you.
Thank you.